end up as part of the recording. We've recorded all of these for about the last year, and the folks at the Voice Library, Rick working with me here today, have been nice enough to digitize them, and they're available through the actual course, not course catalog, library catalog. So today, we're very, very lucky to have Christina Fava with us. And Christina is on a one-year slot here. She's an ethnomusicologist. But when we often say ethnomusicologist, we forget that one of the ethnos happens to be American music. And Christina's work is in American music, specifically her dissertation at the Eastman School in Rochester was on 1930s era, specifically music and social change, which is really the basis of her talk today. She actually started as with a BA in clarinet performance. And I remember the clarinet only too well because my sister played clarinet. So I listened to all of those wonderful clarinet tunes when my sister was in high school. But after her BA in clarinet performance, before she went on to academic life, she actually was a promoter and organizer of music festivals in her native Italy. And so maybe at the question and answer period, we can ask her about that. But we're very, very happy to have Christina here today. She's going to be talking on the topic, Drawing a Finer Point in 1930s Era Success, Pins and Needles and the ILGWU's Lesson for the Theater Guild. So please help me in welcoming Christina Fava.
Well, first of all, let me thank John for inviting me to present on this fascinating topic and for the very nice presentation. Thank you very much. And then I thank you all for coming. And I want to briefly tell you what this paper is going to be about. I will start with some historical background on the workers' theater movement, and then I will focus on the two shows, musical reviews, Parade and Pins and Needle, and I will look also at the critical review, at the contemporary accounts to understand what the actual reaction was to the two shows. And then I will compare some features of Parade with Pins and Needles to show, to demonstrate why Pins and Needles became such a major success, and on the other hand, Parade turned into a veritable fiasco. So here it is, let's start. By the late 1920s, workers' social clubs in Europe and in the United States, motivated in part by a strong sense of class consciousness, had established dramatic groups dedicated to the production of agitprop theater for working class audiences. I'm glad it stopped. the bell was. The workers' theater movement, from now on WTM, took cues from Soviet agitprop and German expressionist theaters and adapted their theatrical form of a one-act play with simple sets based on episodes loosely connected by song and workers' chants. The WTM was an amateur theater as it drew its actors, playwrights, and directors mainly from the working class. These troops considered their principal goal to be agitation, not entertainment. Thus, plots described local strikes or labor issues. On both sides of the ocean, the WTM shared many historical, structural, and ideological traits, yet crucial cultural and socio-political differences rendered the movement in the United States a unique experience. From the onset, because of a multiracial characteristic of American worker forces, theater units seeking to mobilize and entertain specific communities performed in their own language and offered plays that reflected their own culture and tradition. But by the early 1930s, the American WTM comprised a majority of English-speaking groups and focused its productions on current events that were peculiar to the American experience, exposing such issues as xenophobia and other racialist stances. For instance, the Sacco and Vanzetti trial and the Scottsboro case were among these topics often discussed in this place. So this new theater developed also a distinctively American character that incorporated features from such genre as minstrel shows, vaudeville, and variety shows. Eventually, in the second half of the 1930s, the WTM also effectively used music as a propaganda tool and exploited its potential in the musical revue. In truth, music had already constituted a fundamental element in the place of the Wobblies and of the earlier WTM groups, a significant step toward the politicization of a musical theater, for instance, had already characterized the 1920s productions of a new playwright's theater, where American minstrelsy, vaudeville, and revue often appeared next to agitprop skits of European social drama and Marxist doctrine. But the efforts of the new playwrights to encourage activism by employing American musical practices did not create a sea change in attitude towards their attendance, as none of its productions ran for more than 50 performances. In fact, the radical propagandistic topics and experimental character of their plays overlooked the needs of average American workers who seemingly still preferred to be entertained rather than educated in their leisure time. A trend that continued even later at the height of the Great Depression, when Americans really wanted anything but a reminder of their precarious economic and living conditions. They wanted to laugh and forget their anxieties. This issue became especially critical for the Professional Theater Guild, when, apparently to keep afloat, it turned to the leftist political musical revue. The company, though, had neither a history of leftist involvement nor a mandate to reach a working class audience. The Theatre Guild had begun in 1918 as a private, commercial organization geared toward the production of full-length contemporary art theatre. To ensure financial stability, the Guild's governing board developed a subscription network that, by the end of the 1920s, had reached more than 60,000 in New York and the other cities of the Eastern theater circuit. But even the robust Guild suffered during the Depression as subscriptions fell and financial burdens increased. And to help limit losses and reach a wider audience, in its 1934-35 season, it turned to two propagandistic works with social significance. One is They Shall Not Die by John Wexley in 1934, which is a play dealing with the Scottsboro case. And the other one is, of course, Parade, the musical revue Parade, which is a satire, or wanted to be a satire, of a New Deal and the failure to live up to its promises. So Parade then featured, the show featured a Labor Day parade in which the story behind each float became a satirical sketch about issues related to unions and the workers and the workers' struggle. The writers, George Sklar and Paul Peters, provided the basic material of the show, and Jerome Morris composed most of the music, even though several other composers contributed to the music and the sketches. Among others, Mark Blitzstein contributed the sketch Send for the Militia. The Theatre Guild opened a tryout of Parade at the Colonial Theatre in Boston in May 6, 1935. The 28 original acts, yes, 28 acts of the show included musical numbers sympathetic to the working class, such as sketches satirizing capitalism, fascism, and other perceived enemies of the proletariat. The program notes left no doubt about the producer's expectations. Parade in 1935 set to music. We are living in an unusual times. We are inclined to take some of the foibles of a day too seriously. Others we pass by too lightly. Parade is designed to give you a perspective. It is bright, witty, and nimble, and yet it has a sting. It is, in fact, a review with a definite idea and not just a potpourri of songs and sketches about sex and love and the moon above. The result, though, failed to match the producer enthusiasm, as no one took the Theatre Guild seriously as a promoter of left-wing politics. The extreme propagandistic issues in Parade might have appealed to the militant audience of the WTA, but they frightened the Guild's heavily middle-class subscriber base. The force of a political message threatened to obscure the sound dramatic construction of some of the sketches, and negative reviews greeted opening night at the Colonial. Helen Eager of a Boston Traveler wrote, "There was no one at the Colonial last evening at 11:45 who had not been thoroughly reminded that there was a depression bowing down these United States, that starvation was stalking the land. Realism, often to start for comfort, much less amusement, frequently overwhelms the satire." An even harsher verdict came from Eleanor Hughes of the Boston Herald. "The audience came with the evident intention of being pleased. It is a safe guess that by the time Parade was over, it was either bewildered, alarmed, or annoyed. As the evening wore on, matters grew more and more serious until entertainment became propaganda, and those members of the audience who had come to be amused wondered whether they had not made a mistake." In light of these reviews, the authors of Parade revised and changed some numbers, also cutting some numbers of the show, before its broader premiere. But cutting and polishing could not mitigate the overt propagandistic tone of the sketches, and the socially conscious musical review ran in New York for only 40 performances at a loss to the Theatre Guild of approximately $100,000. Only a few sketches won praise for wit and fine craftsmanship, but for the most, critics suggested that the communistic aspect of the review had been exaggerated. Evidently, Parade suffered from an identity crisis. It met the expectations of neither a leftist propaganda piece nor a mainstream satirical review. The Guild had no credentials as a promoter of left-wing politics, and the show treated its material too realistically to be received as merely entertaining satire. Percy Hammond commented on in the New York Herald Tribune, "The USA, one gathers from Parade, is the land of a hill and the home of a knave. The bird of freedom is a buzzard, and the star-spangled banner with its candlestick colors is a tawdry rag, emblematic of oppression." After the fiasco, Moros, the musical director of Parade, analyzed the show's failure and recognized that trying to raise the political review to the formal level of a professional review, he and his collaborators had adhered too closely to the principles of a commercial musical theater rather than formulating new rules peculiar to the revolutionary theater. He then also theorized guidelines for the successful leftist writer seeking to convey a socio-political content. For instance, he suggested that the revolutionary review should combine both musical comedy and review forms telling an important story in swift-moving five-minute blackouts review fashion. Rome also argued that settings should be simple and minimal, possibly just heightened by exciting lighting, so that the audience would not be distracted by elaborate sets and instead focus on the meaning of the various numbers. In the end, he summarized, "I envision a new review in America. It is one of the most important types of native culture yet to be developed, and it should be restored to the working class, from whose vaudeville and minstrel show entertainment it came." And indeed, history proved that when it addressed the larger audience, the target audience, with intelligent satire and wit, and in a simple and direct musical idiom, the musical review developed into an important and in many ways the most far-reaching expression of the WTA, as the stunning success of Pins and Needles showed. So let's look at these Pins and Needles and its genesis. Pins and Needles was produced by an amateur cast and addressed an audience of workers and combined political satire, vaudeville, skit, and Tin Pan Alley songs. Its production history really reads, to some extent, like a fairy tale. In 1935, the American Federation of Labor voted at its annual convention to sponsor labor drama as an educational tool for the cultural enhancement of workers. In response to this resolution, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, from now on ILGWU, otherwise we are here until tomorrow, acquired the Princess Theater on 39th Street, renamed it Labor Stage, and organized classes in the performing arts for its workers. Louise Schaeffer, who was the director, formed the amateur company ILGWU Players. And then he arranged for instructions from Victor Wolfson of the Theatre Union and other prominent professionals. Harold Rome wrote the bulk of the review's lyrics and music, but other writers and composers prominent in the workers' movement, for instance Arthur Arendt, Charles Friedman, and again Mark Blitzstein, contributed to the show as well. At first, a semi-professional company, the Contemporary Players, presented Pins and Needles for an invited audience and members of the union on June 23, 1936. The performance took place in a small studio above the main auditorium of the Labor Stage. Rome and composer Earl Robinson accompanied at the piano. Ben Irwin, who was the critic of a Daily Worker, and he was present at this performance, he praised the production for its revolutionary approach to the genre. He said, "Pins and Needles is certainly a heroic and ambitious enterprise, heroic in a definite sense, because with terrifically limited facilities, a small stage and two pianos, its producers have attempted a form of entertainment that is usually accompanied by a full-fledged orchestra, revolving stage, enormous cast, and a full staff of high-paid technicians." Thus, to some extent, Pins and Needles follows closely Morrow's prescription for successful workers' theater and demonstrated that elaborate costumes and choreography, so central to Broadway productions, were unnecessary in a review with something to say. The success of the showcase convinced Schaeffer and the ILGWU to move ahead with performances by the union's amateur forces. Rome and his collaborators spent a year revising the show and planning for studio tryouts during the summer of 1937. Eventually, Pins and Needles moved to the main auditorium on November 27 for a regular run in front of a paying audience. The 55 original cast members, male and female, represented 10 of the 38 metropolitan branches of the ILGWU, from the corset and brassier workers local to the dressmakers local and the bonnets embroiderers local, just to name a few. At first, they performed only on weekends, but after a month, box office receipt encouraged Schaeffer to commence nightly performances too, and he obtained leaves of absence for the actors from their regular factory jobs and enrolled them in chorus equity and as junior members of actors equity. Still though, these workers gained no economic advantage over other members of the ILGWU. They received exactly the same pay as their co-workers. Because of the show's popularity, a second company, directed by Robert Gordon, performed 5 o'clock matinee. In the spring of 1937, Pins and Needles played as many as 15 performances a week with a full capacity theater. Eventually, the ILGWU players left the 299-seat auditorium of a labor stage, and in June 1939 moved to the Windsor Theatre, which was a slightly bigger house, about 400 seats. The company also presented on February 3, 1938, a command performance at the White House for President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor. And when garment workers and general audience alike clamored for a nationwide road tour, ILGWU officials created a third company, and the original cast went on the road. So at a time when most hit plays lasted an average of 6 months on Broadway, Pins and Needles ran for 1,108 performances, nearly three full years, before closing on June 22, 1940. So Pins and Needles then received incredibly positive reviews. The correspondent for the New York Times considered the ILGWU players a new addition to the growing list of imaginative and youthful theatrical groups which are making monkeys of the folks who think it is fashionable to say the theater is dead. And also, quite unsurprisingly, the failure of Parade appears to have lingered in some critics' mind. For instance, the reviewer of The Times, at the end of his review, he wrote, "All in all, the left-wing theater may take pride in this delayed descent from the usual soap box." Surely a veiled reference to Parade. And Richard Lockridge of a New York Sun commented that for the first time in the labor stage history, they can laugh at themselves as well as their antagonists. The topicality of Pins and Needles partly accounts for this incredible success. Let's look at the program of the first production, the premiere when it opened on November 27th in 1937. It was directed by Charles Friedman and produced by Louis Schaeffer, and it included these 19 numbers. We see sketches that told popular front lines regarding racial equality, justice and commitment to freedom, rejection of fascism and oppression, and concerns, of course, for the workers. Yet they also skewered broader issues ranging from world politics and anti-war sentiment to high taxes and then the growing labor movements, both in the USA and also abroad. For instance, anti-fascist satire becomes the focus of the numbers such as Mussolini Handicap, Public Enemy Number One, and especially for Little Angels of Peace, in which the leaders of the Axis powers in Europe and Asia, like Hitler, Mussolini, the Emperor Hirohito, and Eden, the British foreign ministers at the time, they promote themselves as the four little angel of peace. Of course, I only gave you the words of the opening of the first strophe and then the reprise at the end, but I will play the song in a moment. I want to point out that the music is also filled with very subtle and intelligent humor, not just the words of a song. For instance, catchy barbershop harmonies on the word harmony, or use of the typical Italian, well, Neapolitan mandolin when Mussolini speaks, or of the German folk song Ach du lieber Augustin when Hitler takes the stage. So there are a lot of jokes, musical jokes too, that the audience would certainly appreciate. And this is an image of the original production. As you can see, that on your left is Mussolini. And this is Hitler, and they have wings, so they are on stage dressed like angel with wings. And the show that they put on in this show, they sing and they fight in slapstick fashion, almost like a minstrel show. And then in the end, they are all beaten. So here, let me play the music.
Four little angels of peace are we, loving our neighbors so peacefully. There's really no harm if we do not disarm, for we're always in close harmony. of peace are we. There is one thing on which we agree, with foe or with friend we will fight to the end, just for peace, peace, peace.
Though we butchered the Boers on their own native shores and slaughtered the Irish no end, though on India we poured, slaying horde upon horde, we were playing the part of a friend. Yes, our arms we increased, but we're really for peace, except in the case of a crook. We conquered both spheres, now we're up to our ears, just trying to keep what we took.
Three little angels of peace are we, living together so blissfully. Oh, we never fight unless we're in the right, but we're always in the right, you see. Three little angels of peace are we. There is one thing on which we agree. Until we are wrecks, we'll break each other's necks just for peace, peace, peace.
Generous might, but the emperor knows peace is finer. It isn't our fault, it's a case of a sword. We're picked down and buried by China. Oh, how we deplore a gluttony for a war. We're a nation of poets and thinkers, our soul. Though we bomb without pity and lay waste to each city, it's because all the Chinese are stinkers.
Two little angels of peace are we, living together in amity. We'll sign any pact saying we won't attack, but that's just a mere formality. Two little angels of peace are we. There is one thing on which we agree. We try to keep calm when we gas and we bomb, just for peace, peace, peace. Now I know that a war is a thing to abhor, and that a peace will fill our cornucopia. With a love from the start, I just did my part to civilize dear Ethiopia. Though you call me sadistic, imperialistic, my armies require a quarry. And though we may slay hordes of Spaniards each day, after all, don't we say that we're sorry?
Though I fall for the urge of a nice bloody purge, and leave in my wake piles of carrion, though I clean up my schmutz with a real Nazi putsch, it is all for the sake of the Aryan. My ambitions are small, I want nothing at all, my plans couldn't be any littler. Now that Austria's Nazi, it would be hutsy-tutsy to put the whole world under Hitler.
Four little angels of peace are we, reeking with odor of sanctity. Though we slaughter the meek, we confer every week, and we talk it over peacefully. Four little angels of peace are we. There is one thing on which we agree. With shot and with shell, we give each other hell just for peace.
So that was one of the most successful numbers of the show. But there were Pins and Needles not only offered satire of current political and economic events, entertainment values and intelligent humor also spiced up songs about working class romance. For instance, the second number that they presented on opening night, which is called Why Sing of Skies above, indicates the light-hearted humor forthcoming in the show as the girls, they demand that the boys sing songs that have social significance. Sing as a song with social significance, or you can sing till you are blue, let meaning shine from every line, or we won't love you. So with this song, the workers parodied themselves and the very idea of left-wing musicals by mocking the requirements that songs must have social significance. This is shorter, and I really want to play because the words will scroll down.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. A song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
So the sensational run of Pins and Needles took everyone by surprise, and as noted by many, it signaled the entrance of the left-wing theater into the field of a Broadway musical revue. The gaiety and freshness of the show can account for its success, especially if compared with the earlier production of the WTM. As a New York Times correspondent remarked, in New York, the drama study groups of the various locals had for a long time been staging the usual sort of agitprop sketches, grim little items which for the most part were soliloquies on to strike or not to strike, or depicted the drab and colorless lives of the workers until they joined the union, after which everybody lived happily ever after. Many of them ended with the fist and strident rendition of Solidarity Forever. Even the workers were bored. In short, critics emphasized that a combination of social meaning and musical review defined the essence of Pins and Needles. But I would argue also an idiosyncratically American quality, reminiscent of the wobbly, irreverent songs and skits from two decades earlier, also permeate this satire and comedy of Pins and Needles. these genuine and somewhat naive attributes appealed to the audience more than the dark and angry features of the edgy prop street dramas of the workers' theater movement, or even of the bitter propagandistic sketches of Parade. American audiences found it difficult to accept the rigid stereotypical images used in agitprop plays because they portrayed a world they did not belong to. Rome's competent and lighter yet still prickly sketches depicted real people and situations to which the audience could easily relate. For instance, the New York family planning a Sunday in the park as the only affordable form of entertainment, or the bazaar girl who is unable to find a job anywhere but behind the counter at Macy's, or a consumption-oriented woman who avidly follows advertisement suggestions in the hope of finding a man, but nobody makes a pass at her. So the lyrics with which workers make fun at themselves in Pins and Needles are funny, witty, and very subtle. On the other hand, writers Peter and Sklar's gruesome attempts in Parade to ridicule the Red Scare and stereotypical conservative views came off as a dull form of theatrical suicide, with anonymous actors chanting this text from a darkened stage. How could any production expect to succeed? Destruction is our chief delight. We plot in cellars in the dead of night. Our diet is buckshot and dynamite. We are the tabloid rats. We eat little children with gunpowder sauce. We make little bombs which we love to toss. And if we miss, we are very cross. We are the tabloid rats, and so on. So they were trying to be funny and to bring satire and parody, but it was very gruesome, and it wasn't greeted with success by the audience. But on the others, on the contrary, by in contrast, Rome's witty and biting lyrics in another song, like Doing the Reactionary, for instance, made the audience laugh while satirizing the same conservative behaviors. The song here turns right-wing stance into a fashionable dance, equivalent to doing the foxtrot. It also makes fun of a series of songs that were very popular in the 20s and 30s, doing the Apache, doing the Waltz, doing the Fox. So it makes fun at also Timpan Alley's production in this sense. But if you look at the chorus, the words, don't go left, but be polite, move to the right, doing the reactionary. So it's being a reactionary is very easy. Everyone can do it. It's like doing the foxtrot. It's like dancing, you can do it, just move on, don't look back, go in your direction, and don't look at what's going on behind you. But this very, this satire, this intelligent satire, might not have succeeded if Pins and Needles had failed to give American workers a familiar musical idiom, not mass songs and propagandistic sketches or workers' chants, but Timpan Alley tunes. And let's keep doing the reactionary and as an example, and you'll see it perfectly fits into the standardized form. We have a four-measure introduction which establishes the tonic, which in this case is C minor, and then concludes in a half cadence. Then we have our verse, which is 12, very balanced, 12 measures, three phrases each four measures, and the verse sets the joke. It says, being a reactionary is but a dance. And then we have our chorus, perfect lyric binary chorus, A-A-B-A. It has a refrain, it is repeated, and then the ending of a repetition is that little coda, nine measures of coda. So it's really the perfect standardized form. And in the chorus, of course, the words lampoons the ease with which these politicians and tycoons, they move from left to right with their eyes closed, and they seem not to acknowledge what they leave behind. And I will play eventually the song, but I want before that to point out an interesting unconventional moment in this conventional form. So It is almost as though the conventionality of a musical structure helps Rome stress the social meaning of the lyrics, because he subtly undermines the norm to bring out the political satire. In various examples, and the most evident is the one that occurs at the end of the second phrase of A section. It's not the best image, but it is. If you look at the second staff, it's just the beginning on the words "doing the reactionary." So at that point, the words are sang on a bluesy A flat major with flattened seven. But the most interesting aspect is that the subdivision of the word "reactionary," which is quite inelegant, and it seemed, and the melodic line seems to stumble on that division. Also, if you notice, it ends exactly on the fourth beat of a measure, which is a weak beat, and generally that doesn't happen at the end of a phrase in a song. At the end of a phrase, it ends on the third or on the second, not on the fourth. It gives you that impression that there is a the melodic line is stumbling. And what happens here, it is that Rome might have used that blue note and this unusual phrase ending and subdivision of a word to emphasize the irregularity of being a reactionary. So on that word reactionary, he makes a joke with the music to show the irregularity of being a reactionary. And in the available recording of commercial recording of this song, a very, very young Barbara Streisand, when she performs these lines, she seems to emphasize even more that irregularity by, especially in the repetition of the chorus, by singing with a very prominent nasal voice. There is a nasal inflection, and she seems to emphasize even more that inelegant ending of a phrase. So let me go back, so that you can follow the song. And it happens every time she says reactionary, but especially in the second.
It's darker than the dark bottom. It rumbles more than the rumba. If you think that the two-step got 'em, just take a look at this number. It's got that certain swing that makes you wanna sing. Don't go left, but be polite. When the reactionary, close your eyes to where you're bound, and you'll be found doing the reactionary. All the best dictators do it, millionaires keep stepping to it, the 400 love to sing it, Ford and Morgan swing it, hand up high and shake your head. You'll soon see red doing the reactionary.
Don't go left, but be polite. Move to the right,
doing the reactionary.
Close your eyes to where you're bound, and you'll be found
doing the reactionary.
All the best dictators do it, millionaires keep stepping to it, the 400 love to sing it,
Ford and Morgan swing it,
hand up high and shake your head, you'll soon see red
doing the reactionary. So get in it, begin it.
So it may be that Barbara Streisand responds so well to the tension in the vocal line because she learned, maybe she preserved a performance tradition that she learned from Harold Rome, who was the pianist. He was performing at the piano in this song. So maybe he taught her how to emphasize even more that unconventional moment in an otherwise very conventional structure. We don't know, but it evidently points it out. And The political and social impact of the sketches included in Pins and Needles did not go unnoticed. Even though Schaeffer wanted to avoid communist allusions in the show, many of the ILGWU men and women, as well as the professionals who joined the second and third casts, were left-leaning or directly involved with the Communist Party. They knew exactly which jokes Rome and his collaborators intended to make and what the lyrics implied. The review, in reality, became a powerful image of an emerging American working class, to the point that as Ringer, Lee Morrison, Ringer are the professionals who were hired for the second and third company because they couldn't use all workers of the union, otherwise no one would make undergarments anymore. So to the point that, as Lee Morrison recalled, it turned into a catalyst for politicians in search of public exposure. She also emphasized that the degree of political involvement of cast members, she said, the actors were very socialistically minded. They knew what it was like to be a worker. They weren't like the intellectual communist sympathizers who had no idea what it was like to be a worker, end quote. So in conclusion, political implications aside, many of the review's songs became entrenched in national musical consciousness, hummed by the average Joe in public and danced to in private. They became the soundtrack to workers' everyday life, as Michael Denning argues, though their forms were taken from Tin Pan Alley songs. They became as much the folk songs of New York's garment workers as were the Southern Mill songs of Gastonia's Ella Mae Wiggins or the mining ballads of Harlan County's Aunt Molly Jackson's and Sarah Hogan Gunning. In this way, Pins and Needles succeeded where Parade failed. It filled the workers' need for socially meaningful and at the same time enjoyable entertainment. Thank you. For the tryout.
What did?
No, it's typical. It was typical of musical theater production, especially in the 1930s and 40s, to have tryout out of New York, and Boston and Philadelphia were the two main cities where they would try.
Yeah, I understand that. I guess
Well, I have not encountered any detail on that, but I would assume that because the Theatre Guild was a professional company and they just followed their channels, that's where they usually tried out their shows and that's where they went without even thinking about the consequences.
Well,
I would assume.
Michael's point, and ask it again in a different way. Boston would seem to be a very, very different theater audience than New York City. That is that it wouldn't be as sympathetic, much more Brahmin kind of city in its own way than New York, even though Boston was still unbelievably working class, but in the left wing was so prominent in New York, and not in the same way prominent in Boston. So as I think you're really raising, it's going into hostile territory rather than opening first in a place where it would be more likely to succeed.
In my research I have like dozens and dozens of reviews and they are all on. I just picked a couple. But what I'm saying is that I think that they had no idea it was going to be greeted in that way. And as I said, as they just followed their own traditional channels, and then they found themselves in a bad situation. So probably that's what I can come up with. But I it's a good question. Maybe I should look and see if there is any evidence in the archives that talks about that. Yes.
Yeah. I came today I was able to attend this summer a performance at Oberlin College in their summer repertory theater of The Cradle of Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, I don't know enough about the subject to understand how that fits within the timeline of this, because that was WPA funded. And I think Mark
Blitzstein.
Yeah.
But Mark Blitzen is the author of The Cradle of Rock. Yeah. He wrote the plot, words, and music. It was, The Cradle of Rock, he composed The Cradle of Rock in 1936, in the summer of 1936. Okay. And then he presented the work for the Workers' Theater One Act Play, the Workers' Theater League One Act Play contest. He won, and Orson Welles picked up the play to be produced by one of the units of the Federal Theater project. And that's when what happened then in June, when the show was June 16 was the scheduled day of the premiere of The Cradle of Rock. But the day before, the WPA, actually the Federal Theater Project, Flanagan, the director, she stopped all productions, all new productions of the Federal Theater Project until July 1st, and the reason was unknown. But it seems pretty evident that the problem was with the show of Blitzen with The Cradle of Rock. You know the story then, what happened. Blitzstein contributed a skit for Pins and Needles. If you look, the number 14, FTP Plowed Under, is a sketch that he wrote for the show, in which he, it is a very bitter satire of what happened to his The Cradle of Rock. So he talks about this playwright, his name is Hippity Boomberg, who wrote this play for the Federal Theater Project, but then the director of the Federal Theater Project tells him that it doesn't work, that he has to change the title, because the title was Workers Love 2 or something like that. And they said that it talks about sex, and they don't want to use the money of the taxpayers to contribute to a show that talks about sex. And it's a very funny sketch. We don't have the music anymore. The music there are, as I said, a few sketches, but it is not enough to put together the complete show. So yes, he contributed to this show. It was a very bitter sketch, which did not last in the program of Pins and Needles. And as you talk about The Cradle of Rock, when then the Mercury Theater eventually produced with the Cradle of Rock, starting in at the end of December 1937, the same week that in November 27, Pins and Needles started, and at the same time, The Cradle of Rock started at the Mercury Theater. So. No, they were 143 or 144.
It was pretty polemical about the music. Mm-hmm. was really fun, and one piano player.
Yes. But you know, for instance, we are going to talk about another topic, but it's also interesting and also has to do with workers and union, because the show is about a union, steel workers. And the show, in reality, was not meant to be performed just with a piano, but with an orchestra, full orchestra. The orchestration is actually very, very interesting, and it was also choreographed. It was staged, there were costumes, but because it was interrupted the day of a premiere and they had to move it quickly into another theater, and they were not allowed to use the orchestra player because there were union problems. They couldn't just take them out of a theater project event and use them for a private performance. So that's why it started with the piano. But it's very interesting. That's I have studied that topic a lot too. So maybe later we can talk if you want. But maybe someone wants to ask a question about pins and needles. Yes. Oh, it was Harold Rome. Harold Rome, together with Friedman, when they were the director, Friedman and Harold Rome, and then of course Schaeffer, the director of the ILGWU Players. They had the idea to come up with something that would entertain the workers and at the same time would engage them in some extracurricular activity.
Let me just could you raise a lot of this? You know, I think that what you're doing is, as a comparison, is two different genres and two different examples of music that try not to take themselves too seriously. So as Emma Goldman said, you know, if I can't dance, I don't want to be in your revolution. You know, the Wobblies really were very satirical, but always use hymns or popular tunes to be able to map the new lyrics onto. And in this same way, it seems that what they're doing is by not taking themselves too seriously, they're succeeding.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, I think that, you know, the example that probably all of us use is Upton Sinclair, who said that he really tried to hit America in the brain and hit him in the stomach instead of the jungle. In the same way that if you're overly dramatic, it very well may be that you lose an audience.
Well, Upton Sinclair's Singing Jailbird is one of the plays that was premiered by the New Playwrights Theatre, and that was successful to a certain point. It was probably the most successful of the plays that they produced at the end of the 20s, but still, it was it wasn't enough entertaining for the audience. So it was successful for those who were ready to follow the strict agitprop direction, but the general worker didn't really appreciate those shows.
Other questions?
It's clear that there's a lot of class issues in this, but it also seems clear that there are, for example, Bassett Girl Finds a Job, this is a period of backlash against first-wave feminism, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about maybe some of the gender issues that are also involved.
Oh. That's a very good question. I have not considered that specific topic when I considered Pins and Needles. I was more interested in trying to understand how the working class reacted to it. I have that song. If you want, I can play the Vassa song so that then we can talk about what she sings. Just a second. Oh. Let me go and get it. Oh, no, I don't have it here. I have Nobody Makes a Pass at Me. Well, but still, it is still.
Well, it's probably very similar.
Yes, and the other one is very bitter because this woman can't find a job even she has a Vassar college degree.
Well,
so it's very, very contemporary.
Right, well, that's what they were saying. They were like, well, if you get an education, you turn into a man. So no, if you get an education, no man, you'll never get married, was the argument.
Mm-hmm. No, 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 no. That was because of a depression and because of a difficulty to find jobs. That didn't have anything to do with gender, with the fact that she was a woman.
I see. Okay, but that's mm-hmm. sort of the backlash in its first feminism.
Mm-hmm. This one is probably most interesting to study as a gender study. It is.
I want men that I can please, that I can squeeze, that I can tease. Two or three or four or more. What are those fools waiting for? I want love and I want kissing. I want more of what I'm missing. Nobody comes knocking at my front door. What do they think my knocker's for? If they don't come soon, there won't be any more. What can the matter be? I wash my clothes with Lux. My etiquette's the best. I spend my hard-earned bucks on just what the ads suggest. Oh dear, what can the matter be? Nobody makes a piss at me. I'm full of Kellogg's bran. I eat grape nuts on the sly. The date is on the can of the coffee that I buy. Oh dear, what can the matter be? Nobody makes a piss at me. Beatrice Fairfax, give me the bare facts. How do you make them fall? If you don't save me, the things the Lord gave me never will be any use to me at all. I sprinkle on a dish a fragrance d'amour. The ads say makes men rash, but I guess their smell is poor. Oh dear, what can the matter be? Nobody makes a piss at me. I use Ovaltine and Listerine, Barbasol and Mustarol, Lifebuoy soap and Flit. So why ain't I got it? I use Coca-Cola and Marmola, Crisco, Lesco and Mazola, X-Lax and Bapex. So why ain't I got sex? I use Albaline and Maybelline, Alka-Seltzer, Bromo-Seltzer, Odorono and Sensation. So why ain't I got fascination? My girdles come from Best. The Times it say they're chic, and up above I'm dressed in the brassiere of the wake. Oh dear, what can the matter be? Nobody makes a piss at me. I use Pons on my skin. With Rye Crisp I have thinned. I get my culture in. I began Gone with the Wind. Oh dear, what can the matter be? Nobody makes a piss at me. Oh Dorothy Dix, please show me some tricks, please. I want some men to hold. I want attention and things I can't mention, and I want them all before I get too old. I use Mum every day and Angela's Lip Lure, but still men stay away. Just like Ivory Soap, I'm 99 and 44, 100% pure. What can the matter be? Nobody makes a piss at me. I don't know. Oh dear.
So clearly they are using gender stereotypes, but also to denounce something else. So this constant the constant advertising that comes through the radio. Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. I guess it's a very interesting term that maybe I should start to look at the songs from that point of view. Yes.
Other questions?
I just have one other quick question. On the touring company, what can you name what places they went to?
Oh, they pretty much went everywhere in the nation. In the major cities, they traveled. There were two.
Detroit?
They went. I'm assuming they went to Detroit. I don't know exactly, but it was like a nationwide. So
yeah.
they traveled twice. There were two major tours that they did. But I can find it for you. But
I was just curious because it sounds like. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one that kind of broke outside and then
mm-hmm. Also, this is a show that ran for 3 years.
Yeah.
So it's not that the 19 numbers that we saw in the slide here, that they were they kept changing and they kept adding new topics. And every time that they change it, they also slightly change the name of a show. Like, for instance, in 1939, in the spring of 1939, they came up with Pins and Needles 1939, following the trend of like the Ziegfeld Follies every year, or of this musical review that kept repeating year by year. Or the same year, at the end of 1939, the last Pins and Needles was called New Pins and Needles, so that the audience knew that they were going to look at different sketches, not always the same.
Other questions or comments? By the way, you were ILGWU locals here in Michigan. Some of the applicants and some here in Baltimore. So it would be logical that if they were trying to go to where ILG locals were, then they very well may have come to Michigan besides going to mm-hmm.
Yes, they were. As I said earlier, the request came from workers, but also came from like general audience because of a successful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what age would the audience member have been?
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how much money the audience spent to see this, and if they were allowed to see it, or if they were at all.
It was, you know what, I can't answer that. I don't know how much they paid to get into the... To watch the show, but I'm assuming that the prices were less than what they paid on Broadway for sure. Yes, and the age, I'm assuming like a wide audience from all spans of life. I'm assuming yes.
Well, let's give Christina another round.